In one way or another, it seems inevitable now that the new standard of well-being which the mechanical revolution of the last century has rendered possible should become the general standard of life. Revolution is conditional upon public discomfort. Social peace is impossible without a rapid amelioration of the needless discomforts of the present time. A rapid resort to willing service and social reconstruction on the part of those who own and rule, or else a worldwide social revolution leading towards an equalization of conditions and an attempt to secure comfort on new and untried lines, seem now to be the only alternatives before mankind. The choice which route shall be taken lies, we believe, in Western Europe, and still more so in America, with the educated, possessing, and influential classes. The former route demands much sacrifice, for prosperous people in particular, a voluntary assumption of public duties, and a voluntary acceptance of class discipline and self-denial. The latter may take an indefinite time to traverse. It will certainly be a very destructive and bloody process, and whether it will lead to a new and better state of affairs at last is questionable. A social revolution, if ultimately the Western European states blunder into it, may prove to be a process extending over centuries. It may involve a social breakdown as complete as that of the Roman Empire, and it may necessitate as slow a recuperation. 11th. We've dealt with the social and economic disorder of the European communities and the rapid return of the class war to the foreground of attention before giving any account of the work of world settlement that centered on the peace conference at Paris. Because the worried and preoccupied state of everyone concerned with private problems of income, prices, employment, and the like goes far to explain the jaded atmosphere in which that conference addressed itself to the vast task before it. The story of the conference turns very largely upon the adventure of one particular man, one of those men whom accident or personal quality picks out as a type to lighten the task of the historian. We have, in the course of this history, found it very helpful at times to focus our attention upon some individual, Buddha, Alexander the Great, Huan Chuang, the Emperor Frederick II and Charles V and Napoleon I, for example, and to let him, by reflection, illuminate the period in which he lived. The conclusion of the Great War can be seen most easily as the rise of the American president, President Wilson, to predominant importance in the world's hopes and attention, and his failure to justify that predominance. President Wilson, born in 1856, had previously been a prominent student and teacher of history, constitutional law, and the political sciences generally. He'd held various professorial chairs and had been president of Princeton University in New Jersey. There's a long list of books to his credit, and they show a mind rather exclusively directed to American history and American politics. He was mentally the new thing in history, negligent of and rather ignorant of the older things out of which his new world had arisen. He retired from academic life and was elected Democratic governor of New Jersey in 1910. In 1913, he became the Democratic presidential candidate, and as a consequence of a violent quarrel between ex-President Roosevelt and President Taft, which split the dominant Republican Party, he became President of the United States. The events of August 1914 seem to have taken President Wilson, like the rest of his fellow countrymen, by surprise. We find him cabling an offer of his services as a mediator on August the 3rd. Then, for a time, he and America watched the conflict. At first, neither the American people nor their president seem to have had a very clear or profound understanding of that long-gathered catastrophe. Their tradition for a century had been to disregard the problems of the old world, and it wasn't to be lightly changed. The imperialistic arrogance of the German court and the stupid inclination of the German military authorities towards melodramatic frightfulness, their invasion of Belgium, their cruelties there, their use of poison gas, and the nuisance of their submarine campaign, created a deepening hostility to Germany and the United States as the war proceeded. But the tradition of political abstinence and the deep-rooted persuasion that America possessed a political morality altogether superior to European conflicts restrained the president from active intervention. He adopted a lofty tone. He professed to be unable to judge the causes and justice of the Great War. It was largely his high Pacific attitude that secured his re-election as president for a second term. But the world isn't to be mended by merely regarding evildoers with an expression of rather undiscriminating disapproval. By the end of 1916, the Germans had been encouraged to believe that under no circumstances whatever would the United States fight, and in 1917 they began their unrestricted submarine warfare and the sinking of American ships without notice. President Wilson and the American people were dragged into the war by this supreme folly. And also, they were dragged into a reluctant attempt to define their relations to old world politics in some other terms than those of mere aloofness. Their thoughts and temper changed very rapidly. They came into the war side by side with the Allies, but not in any pact with the Allies. They came into the war in the name of their own modern civilization to punish and end an intolerable political and military situation. Slow and belated judgments are sometimes the best judgments. In a series of notes, too long and various for detailed treatment, in this outline, thinking aloud, as it were, in the hearing of all mankind, President Wilson sought to state the essential differences of the American state from the great powers of the old world. We've been at some pains in this history to make plain the development of these differences. He unfolded a conception of international relationships that came like a gospel, like the hope of a better world to the whole Eastern Hemisphere. Secret agreements were to cease. Nations were to determine their own destinies. Militarist aggression was to cease. The seaways were to be free to all mankind. These commonplaces of American thought, these secret desires of every sane man, came like a great light upon the darkness of anger and conflict in Europe. At last, men felt, the ranks of diplomacy were broken, the veils of great power policy were rent in twain. Here, with authority, with the strength of a powerful new nation behind it, was the desire of the common man throughout the world, plainly said. Manifestly, there was needed some overriding instrument of government to establish world law and maintain these broad and liberal generalizations upon human intercourse. A number of schemes had floated in men's minds for the attainment of that end. In particular, there was a movement for some sort of world league, a league of nations. The American president adopted this phrase and sought to realize it. An essential condition of the peace he sought through the overthrow of German imperialism was, he declared, to be this federal organ. This League of Nations was to be the final court of appeal in international affairs. It was to be the substantial realization of the peace. Here again, he awakened a tremendous echo. President Wilson was the spokesman of a new age. Throughout the war, and for some little time after it had ended, he held, so far as the old world was concerned, that exalted position. But in America, where they knew him better, there were doubts. And writing as we do now with the wisdom of subsequent events, we can understand these doubts. America, throughout a century and more of detachment and security, had developed new ideals and formulae of political thought without realizing with any intensity that under conditions of stress and danger these ideals and formulae might have to be passionately sustained. To her community many things were platitudes that had to the old world communities, entangled still in ancient political complications, the quality of a saving gospel.